Hello, Adelaide. What a beautiful thing you are. Good morning. How are we? I'm really thrilled to see you all, and it's a lovely, cool day under the shade cloths and the trees. Welcome to Mental Health Matters at Adelaide Writers Week. This is such a wonderful festival. Thank you to Louise and the entire team for putting it on. It really has been a staggering event this year. An event here on the country of the Kaurna people, over 60,000 years of conversations and knowledge sharing, long before any of us imagined writers' festivals into being, always was, always will be, Kaurna land. Hey, my name is Natasha Mitchell. I'm from ABC's Big Ideas program. Who listens? Oh, thank you. Excellent. Big Ideas goes out Thursdays to Sundays on ABC Radio, Sundays to Thursdays on ABC Radio National, and of course on the ABC Listen app. And we are recording today, just so you that you know. Look, Jonathan Rosen's new memoir, The Best Minds. It is the most profound, the most moving, the most extraordinary read, and please take the opportunity to grab a copy at the bookshop if you get the chance, and there'll be a signing afterwards. It will make you gasp, it will make you cry, it will make you laugh. It really is a profound book. And it's the story of Jonathan's childhood best friend, Michael Lauder. Yeah. And it's a tender and it's a harrowing story about what happened next as they got to know each other throughout their lives. And it's about love and it's about genius and it's about eccentricity and friendship. And it's about the tragedy of good intentions. It's a story of how the way we view and understand and misunderstand mental illness has changed over time. It's the story of the important civil rights and intellectual and literary movements that rose up to challenge medical power and medical abuse and psychiatric paternalism and the stigmatisation of people who had been declared mad. But it's also the story about the devastation that followed and has followed and continues to follow deinstitutionalisation, so the closure of psychiatric hospitals and asylums of old. What came next? Well, that's a challenge, and many of you might be experiencing that challenge yourself or in your families. How do you get the care that you need? How do you get the care that your loved ones need? So I want to acknowledge that today is going to cover some very challenging terrain, but there are threads of hope throughout as well. And it is about the difficulty that loved ones face in supporting their loved ones to get care, but also people getting the care that they feel that they need when they most need it. This is an eternal challenge. It's an American story, but it's very much an Australian story. And it's my great honour to introduce Jonathan Rosen, Best Minds, A Story of Friendship's Madness and the Tragedy of Good Intentions is but one of his number of books. Jonathan's essays and articles have appeared in the New York Times, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The Wall Street Journal, numerous anthologies. He lives with his family in New York City and it is our delight to have you in Australia. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Professor Pat McGorry, Patrick McGorry, no stranger to many of you, former Australian of the Year, no less, Executive Director of Origin, Professor of Youth Mental Health at the University of Melbourne, founding director of the whole movement of centres called Headspace, the Youth Mental Health Service here in Australia, an international leader in early detection and prevention of psychosis, something that we'll talk about today. And welcome, Pat. Lovely to have you here.
Thanks for being in Adelaide.
There's a lot to this story, and the full telling of it will be in the book, obviously, but we'll see what themes we can connect with today. And so, Jonathan, take us back to 1973, and you're 10, and you moved to New Rochelle, just outside of New York, and a kid introduces himself to you. He lives across the road, and every kid's unique. But Michael was an especially exceptional individual, wasn't he?
He was. I met him right away. We lived on a very short street. It was one little block. There were about seven houses. I was at the top of the hill. He was at the bottom, just enough hill to ride a skateboard into a parked car. but Michael was enormously precocious, and he read at lightning speed. Mm. I was a very slow reader and a troubled reader. He had a photographic memory. He would always engage while I was waiting for him to finish so we could go play basketball with my parents, who we immediately called by their first names, the details of the Watergate scandal. He knew all the ins and outs. And
as a kid?
I'm talking about as a 10-year-old. I knew who Nixon was, and I knew he was a crook. That was the limits of my knowledge. He knew every member of the cabinet and what they had done. There was just an immediate connection between us, different as we were. His house was completely different from my house, although his father was a college professor and my father was a college professor.
And you were both bookish.
We were both bookish.
Big time.
Big time. He read them all, sometimes at the same time. In class, he had stacks, and he would just randomly read from them during class. He had permission to read during class because he'd zipped through these required readings called SRAs, and I did not do that. But we were both bookish in that we both wanted to be writers, and so we had that in common. He was constantly introducing me to writers, to books, to words, ideas, and at the same time, he needed someone who listened to him. We shared a sense of humor. And that was how our friendship began. What I was going to say is his father taught economics. Mm. His father wore a leather bomber jacket and had this very aggressive way of meeting the world.
And his name was Chuck.
And his name was Chuck, yes.
As you might imagine.
Even his name was a verb, as I like to say. my father was a refugee from Vienna. Used to walk backwards across the street when Chuck was coming towards him, even though they agreed about a lot of things politically. My father was a very soft-spoken person. He taught German literature. Mm. And so although they were bookish homes, they were very different. Michael had two brothers. He was the youngest of two large older brothers. And there was a kind of wonderful, violent energy in the house. Yeah. I had a sister. We would always defer to each other. And so it was wonderful to go over there for a little while just to absorb that
and get
energy.
The hell out of there at the
And
end.
He loved to come over and sit in our garden and talk to my mom when she was gardening or my sister when she was doing her homework.
But you get this sense that Michael was very much slumming it in childhood. He'd grown up way before childhood began.
Yeah, he reminded me of Merlin in the Once in Future King. He had lived backwards, and he was just at the very end, but he'd already had a whole adulthood. He had tinted aviator glasses. Kids did not wear tinted glasses. But at the same time, there was an enormously forward-leaning quality to him, even the way he walked. His nickname was Toes. He bounced forward. He was very tall. I was only slightly taller, but no one necessarily would have thought of me as tall.
Yeah.
But he was always sort of rising up to meet his future.
That's such an interesting way of putting it. He had multiple nicknames. I think another one was Professor. How did that relationship shape you into your teens and then, I guess, into university?
We were very competitive, despite our great differences. And when we had to dress up as an historical figure in fifth grade, he was FDR, and I had to push him around in the wheeled chair of the swivel chair of the teacher. I was Hawthorne, which my mother, who's a writer, had suggested. I wasn't even sure who I was, and nobody guessed who I was, and I had pretty much dressed like my mother. I was wearing her velvet vest and a ruffly shirt that I thought was writerly. But we were associated with each other. We saw each other almost every day. But then we became competitive in a different way as we got older. When we began high school, we were attacked by a gang of kids the first week of high school. I was very badly beaten. There were like seven kids. Michael got away. He ran away, but then he turned and watched. I was envious of him for as he said, shaking loose because he had street smarts, and he used to play basketball elbows out, whereas I was full of shame that I had not even really quite noticed. There were all these kids around me until one of them put his arm around me and began to punch me in the face. Mm-hmm. But we both felt bad about the outcome and never talked about what happened again. Oh. We both wanted to be the editor-in-chief of the high school paper. I wound up being the editor, but Michael's quit because he didn't want to work for me, whereas I would not have quit
Pride.
Had it been him. He had a colossal ego that I think shaded gradually into a kind of grandiosity, but I was so shy that I saw it as a part of almost an admirable quality, because his ability to project himself into the world and to take up space without apologizing for it, let's say. Whereas in my family, I'm named for a murdered grandfather, my sister's named for a murdered grandmother, both killed in the Holocaust. Just to be alive was already, you might think it was just an affirmation of survival, but it was also almost a guilt-inducing problem, because that you should be there at all. And so we just had very different approaches to the world that I certainly wasn't aware of any of these things. You just accept people and yourself as you are, I think. But we both got into Yale, and
Paths started to diverge then, really, didn't
they? Our paths started to diverge. And Michael said to me the summer before we went that he didn't think he'd see much of me. And I said, why? And he said, well, you're too slow. And I was always in my mind in the tortoise to his hair.
Yeah.
And so on the one hand, it was very, very hurtful. On the other hand, it made a kind of grim, painful sense. But it was also just a spur to my desire to not be
so a defining friendship, those friendships that we form in our first 20 years and that sustain us through those formative years are so vital and so definitional for the rest of our lives, really, aren't they? And so he then, strangely enough, goes to a management consulting firm. It's the 80s. It's the 80s by then, isn't it? Yeah. So you know, the rise and rise of management consulting firms, and he's bright, so he's swept up into that world. He wants to be rich. That doesn't make him happy, and he ends up quitting. But when did things start to unravel? Or when were there signs? What were the earliest signs that he was struggling?
Well, his plan was he graduated college in 3 years with highest honors and went to work for a management consulting firm, which was a newish thing. And as he himself said, it's because he could talk about anything with total conviction. And he really could. So why not monetize it? And he was going to work for 10 years, make a ton of money, and be a writer. I was going to take my tortoise path to victory. I wasn't sure how that was going to work, but I had gone to grad school. But already in his first year, he had begun hallucinating. Mm-hmm. I did not know that. And I'm not sure the people around him knew it, but he felt they were out to get him. I met someone or knew someone who I went to school with who said that he was always convinced that the higher-ups were sort of after him, but would also never let him leave because he was too valuable. And so he left after a year, moved into the attic of a grand house owned by psychiatrists who played a large role eventually in his care, and wrote stories. So I might have known that something was wrong, but when you grow up assuming he's the hare, you just think he's taking a nap and you better keep running. It doesn't occur to you. And it didn't occur to me because he was doing anyway what I most wanted to do, which was live in an attic room with a view of the Long Island Sound and write stories all night, even though he was isolated in his own head and convinced that there were Nazis in the streets of New Rochelle trying to run him over.
Yeah. And so this household, we'll talk about that, because it was part of a whole movement of social psychiatrists who really saw the institution of psychiatry as a devastating cause of mental illness or contributor to mental illness. And so they were trying to provide a different type of model. A response to an insane society was how insanity manifested. Pat, let me bring you in here, because you're very involved and have spearheaded a movement to support young people in the early stages of psychosis. Tell us about what we understand about the risk profile of early psychosis and early psychotic symptoms. I mean, certainly some are drug-induced, but it's a much more complex story there, and we're still piecing it together, and we may never do so.
Well, it doesn't discriminate against anyone. Anyone can become psychotic, so that's the first thing. There is more risk in disadvantaged and marginalised sort of communities, and for example, in immigrants, there are higher rates there because of the. There's two theories there, but the main thing is that it does come on in exactly this age group, teenagers and young adults, as Jonathan described, and. What we've tried to do is detect it early, because if you don't pick it up early, that the outcomes are worse, like they are with any potentially serious or persistent illness. You've got to get it right at the beginning to have the best chances of getting better, and there's really great data on that now, that you, not completely, but you largely miss the boat in achieving recovery if you don't actually pick it up in the early weeks and the months of the illness.
And what are we talking about in those early weeks and months and days?
Well, some people think that the brain is sort of, less responsive to the treatment if it's delayed, but you don't even have to invoke that, and that's not proven. You just think about what's happening to someone's life if they're untreated, you know, for weeks or months at that stage of life when you're supposed to be, like, Michael actually managed to get through to graduation before it struck him. But more commonly, it happens to people before they've established themselves, academically or career-wise, and or with relationships and networks. It's just an exquisitely sensitive period of life to develop any kind of mental health problem, and most mental health problems, conversely, happen at this transitional phase. So that's why
a lot going on.
Yeah. So this is why we focus so much on detecting it early and making sure there's a comprehensive, holistic response to recovery and an optimistic approach. Because when I started psychiatry, I've told you this, Natasha, before, but the pessimism, the kind of iatrogenic pessimism that was transmitted to people with schizophrenia in particular, that there's no hope of recovery. That was such a toxic thing that psychiatrists used to say to people.
And more than what they said. I mean, it manifested as a reality because of the intense stigma around psychosis.
Yeah, and the neglect of the care, which is, as you say, the deinstitutionalised movement was what everyone wanted to see happen at that time, because it appeared that was a 19th century model that had no hope of recovery. You just warehoused people and wrote them off, out of sight, out of mind. So there had to be something better in the 20th century, 21st century for the people. But the tragedy is that they just dismantled that system and didn't build the new one.
It's complicated, though, and there has been robust debate about how early do you intervene, with a kid like Michael, who was an eccentric genius from the moment he, walked into the world, arrived from his mother's womb into the world? There's a risk of pathologising children, isn't there? And that is happening. I think we can absolutely say that is happening.
Yeah, there's a risk of over-treatment and there's a risk of under-treatment, but by far the most common experience is under-treatment. But you're seeing with ADHD and ASD now the risks of over-treatment or over-diagnosing. But with psychosis, I mean, it's like with any other area of healthcare. There's a risk-benefit ratio. So what's the risk of diagnosing too early? We see that with breast cancer and prostate cancer as well. You can go too early and expose people to risks that are not justified, or you can be too late and the person doesn't recover. Mm-hmm. So finding that sweet spot is what we've been working on in our research.
So, Jonathan Rosen, this was an interesting time when Michael started to experience these symptoms, I guess we could call them, with the benefit of hindsight. You write so beautifully about the whole context within which you were growing up in and the challenge to medical models of mental illness. You had the psychiatrist Thomas Satz. I think I did the last interview he ever did, actually, just before he died in his 90s. Extraordinary hour to spend with him. Who wrote The Myth of Mental Illness. You had the psychiatrist, Scottish psychiatrist Ardie Lang, who, you know, declared insanity as a response to an insane world. So there was this... And then there was the... You were doing literature at university. You know, there was the whole literary movement that I think you describe it as mental illness was kind of a literary elixir almost. That's not quite how you said it, but just give us the context that you explore in this book, this sort of political, social, cultural, philosophical, literary soup.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I can say what eventually happened or if you want to eventually say that, but I would only say now then something dreadful winds up happening. And I knew what happened. What happened is that after being celebrated for heroically going to Yale Law School despite his schizophrenia and being is going to be the subject of a movie for which he was paid enormous amount of money and Brad Pitt was going to play him.
But you can see where this story's going. It's phenomenal.
But he went off his medication and he killed someone he loved very much. But what I wanted to say was that in encountering the story, I didn't think of it as a story, even though it has an arc. It was that something dreadful had happened to my friend, to whom I was so deeply connected in all sorts of unexpected ways. And what it started to feel like was like almost like a murder mystery in which everyone was a potential suspect. Why was it that when he was ill, there was no care? Why was it that we grew up in a world where you... losing your mind was a form of mind expansion? And how did all of these things happen? Why was it that in my literature classes you read Foucault's Madness and Civilization and learned that it was only a social construct and that there was no such thing as mental illness? It was just a form of othering people who were different. And of course, there's always abuse. But the idea that it was merely a semantic affliction and could therefore be cured rhetorically is itself a kind of madness. And I was inside of all of these things. And I would add to that that my family, and I think Michael's too, were both steeped in psychoanalysis. And that was the dominant mode of psychiatry that these anti-psychiatrists you mention rebelled against. The chairman of every psychiatry department at every medical school was a psychoanalyst. And in psychoanalysis does not accept the medical model of illness. It believes that you are made ill. Everyone is made ill for the same reason, that there is a repressed emotion or conflict in childhood. And if it affects you a tremendous amount, perhaps you'll become psychotic. And if it doesn't, maybe you'll just be neurotic. And that in the same way that it's like applied mythology. Oedipus, a Greek myth, makes you sick. And telling your story makes you well. It was a fantasy for literary people. My parents, who were both very literary, assumed it made perfect sense. Telling your story would heal you. And the problem is that Freud borrowed from people who were severely ill, but he didn't treat them. And there was a time when psychiatrists were called alienists, and they all functioned inside of psychiatric hospitals. But if you could be a psychoanalyst, then you could just have an office like a dentist and have normal hours and treat people formerly considered well, and then, you know, go home at the end of the day. And so, first of all, they deinstitutionalized themselves. But also, the psychiatry against which anti-psychiatry was rebelling was in many ways already a departure from a medical biological world. And in the aftermath of the Second World War and the Holocaust, where genetics was applied erroneously to demonize people, everyone wanted to get as far away.
You can understand.
Hitler's doctor called Nazism applied biology. And so the idea of biology itself, it was falsely applied, but even if it had been accurately applied, our morality doesn't come from biology. And so all of these complexities suddenly became things I needed to think about instead of just, wow, wouldn't it have been great to have been a teenager in the 60s when everybody was so free.
But you articulate your teenage life in the 60s in such a beautiful, evocative way in this book. It's extraordinary. Pat McGorry, your career came... You came of age as a psychiatrist, as a doctor, and then a psychiatrist through this time, didn't you? So were you responsive to that as someone who's a progressive thinker and, you know, has wide interests and passions? Did you walk into psychiatry going, this is the model that I'm going to follow, thank you very much?
Well, I thought the way Jonathan has covered this in the book is just incredible, you know. Yeah. Just the best piece of writing about this I've ever seen.
I agree.
Actually.
Mm.
And the dilemmas that it sort of raises. I was a medical student in the 70s when anti-psychiatry was at its peak. I was very taken with it because of the human rights aspect of it, that the people were so badly treated by society, othered, I think you use that word, and their care was just, you know, on a different level, you know, to any other part of healthcare, and it was still in these 19th century asylums or in those systems of care which were split off.
So why'd you go into psychiatry?
Well, I put it off for a while, but then I realised it, you know. I did realise that it was real, this idea that the mental illness was a myth or a social construction was nonsense, actually. It was a real thing, it was a real illness, especially those more severe forms, which I was very interested in, schizophrenia and psychosis. And I thought I had to get immersed in it. The only way to do that was to sort of start training in psychiatry. And it was really, you know, it was an inhumane sort of system as well, because of the institutionalisation sort of effect. And there's still an element of that, obviously, today, which people in the audience probably have experienced. Mm-hmm. But I think psychoanalysis was one form of reductionism, seeing everything in a psychological frame. And then you had this reaction to it, which was biological reductionism, which was a return to that sort of very brain disease type thinking. And both of them are inadequate to it. This is what attracted me to psychiatry, because you're able to think about the brain, you're able to think about the psychology of the mind.
And the life trajectory and the impact of trauma.
Exactly. And also, and I worked with refugees a lot too, so I saw that. But also the social context. And, you know, thinking of refugees, the environment that we have here in Australia that's made their mental ill health so much worse by the social and political environment around them, you see that too. So psychiatry offers you a chance to learn about all of those causes and influences on mental health. And, you know, but the system doesn't allow you to really practice in that way, to sort of deliver the care, holistic care. So that's what I've tried to do, build holistic systems of care that don't throw any babies out of the bath, you know. And that's a hard thing to do because, you know, the funding and the philosophy, you have these ideological fights still these days in mental health.
The quick fix. Let's come back to Michael Lauder's story, Jonathan, your childhood friend. And so Michael quits the management consultancy job and he is spiralling into psychosis. He then spends 8 months inside a psychiatric hospital and emerges from that experience, and you visit him inside the hospital, but yes. He emerged from that experience very much changed, didn't he? In some sense, you get this sense that he's... And this is a common experience for friends who I know who have experienced psychosis. You profoundly grieve who you were and you profoundly grieve what you've lost. And so despite the fact that there's hopeful pathways for you, you still know that you've lost something very profound and you've seen something very dark. So why did he end up at Yale Law School? And why was that possible? Because, in fact, he was very unwell while he was doing that degree. But people rallied for him, didn't they? Such was his charisma.
Yes. He had applied to law school before his full psychotic break. What I described was prodromal, I guess, is the word you'd use. These were these gradually escalating episodes. But then he had one very intense break where he was convinced his parents were Nazi replicas of his actual parents who had been killed and whose dead bodies were in the attic. And so he armed himself with a kitchen knife, and eventually his mother called the police and he wound up in the hospital. Mm. But He spent his long spell in the hospital, where, yes, he was grieving, but he was also chastened in many ways, full of self-recrimination. It was a very different person I'd ever encountered before. And he was also medicated. And the medication itself had an effect, a powerful effect on him. It was very imprecise. He always described himself as a broken television set. And he said, the doctors just whack me on the side or move the antennas around.
Yeah.
But even with that crude instruments, they were able to sort of restore him sufficiently so that he could then gradually begin a path back. And he went to a halfway house. But it was while he was in the hospital, he learned he'd gotten into every law school. He rejected them all, as he put it, except for Yale, which he deferred, or had his brother defer. And then he was in a halfway house. And although he did grieve for his lost sense of promise, the paradox, I think, for him of being medicated was that, in a way, he did not entirely see himself as ill. So even in the halfway house, and this has a cultural element as well, he always described himself as the McMurphy character. McMurphy is the hero of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, especially the movie, which is what we knew, although he read the book too, of course. The movie's quite different, but the point is the same. And the point is that McMurphy isn't mentally ill. He's almost like a Kafka character. He's a victim of mysterious circumstances. Somehow he's just there. And so if you see yourself as the McMurphy character, one might have said, does that mean he doesn't in fact see himself as ill? And the answer was partly yes. And so every effort to accommodate his illness or set him on a slow path of recovery seemed almost like an insult to him. And his father, when his father heard that one of the doctors suggested maybe he could work at Macy's, drove him to Macy's department store, which literally says the biggest department store in the world on the side in Manhattan. And there, all the people at the returns counter were swamped by angry customers. And partly the sense was, this is a very stressful thing to do. Partly it was his father saying, why should my son do this when he can go to Yale Law School?
Yeah.
And Michael used to say, why would I bag groceries, as he put it, or work at a checkout counter when I could go to Yale Law School?
Yeah. The reality was, though, that he experienced all the things that people do experience because there's a lack of support. He experienced poverty for the first time in his life. He was from a privileged household. But he was complicated to deal with for his family, wasn't he? So he did experience some of those challenges of living in a halfway house. And try to make a go of it. But he did land in Yale Law School, and people really rallied for him, didn't they? And he started to find, at some point, he finds the voice of advocacy, doesn't he?
He does, but I think what I was astonished to discover when I was researching the book was that his professors both recognized him as brilliant and also as someone who could not do the work. And one of his professors said to me, a wonderful man, said, I didn't think he would be a Yale lawyer. I thought he would be someone who had been to Yale Law School, who could be an advocate for people with schizophrenia. The problem with that is that Michael was the one who used to say, and he said it a lot to me, why would I work at Macy's when I can be a Yale lawyer?
Yeah.
And nobody told him. They're in their mind, their accommodation would somehow, the intention of it would become reality. And it didn't occur to them that they were equipping him, they were allowing him to believe that he was doing something that, in fact, was not entirely what he was able to do. And still, his fellow students, who were enormously and instinctively helpful to him without knowing, he told his professors right away. This one professor said to me he was almost profligate with the way he shared the information, but only very gradually he told a tiny handful of people. They all assumed he was a genius because he carried himself like one, and he still had a remarkable mind. It's just that he couldn't sustain the thought or do the work.
And in some sense, you describe that that genius became a mask for what his needs really were, which was more medical support. And he writes an opinion piece or a story in the New York Times, and really everything changes after that. It's such a powerful story, this story of reclamation and, you know, from Bedlam to Yale Law School, and it really captures the hearts and minds of a community of people who are living with mental illness who desperately need role models, positive role models like Michael. There is a profound need for these stories to connect with people, to destigmatise the experience of psychosis. And Ron Howard gets in touch, Hollywood director, and they buy the option to his story. They option the rights for however you say that. They want to turn his story into a Hollywood blockbuster, and so that starts to happen.
Yes. The only thing I'd say is that the profile in the Times was written by a reporter, a very well-meaning reporter.
Ah, it wasn't
but
Michael.
Everyone remembers it as a piece he wrote.
Yes, I do
because
too.
Because he is the governing intelligence in it. And his formulations are all the ones that were quoted. Mm. And then, but it ends with a quote from the dean of Yale Law School saying he's conquered his illness, as if it were a mountain you climbed, which was a misrepresentation of his illness because he was still hallucinating. But it also contained these, I felt rotten reading it because I was impressed, happy for him, but deeply disquieted because he was asked if he ever became violent, as he reported, as a way of saying that the people interviewing him for a job as a professor of law somehow held what he called a hateful stereotype, which is a hateful stereotype, but I knew he'd patrolled his house with a kitchen knife because he was defending himself against his Nazi replica parents. And so nobody inquired into the nature of that. The story itself was built around him. The headline said, A Voyage from Bedlam and Halfway Back. It's an echo of the title of a collection of poems by Anne Sexton, who is a Sylvia Plath's friend, a wonderful poet who committed suicide, who suffered from bipolar disorder, who often didn't take medication. But it was more about the echo of literature, as if he had been gathered into the arms of poetry, and that was somehow bestowing on him a promise of recovery through art, through literature. The actual headline, that was the headline, and the deck said, like a brilliant student encumbered by an invisible wheelchair, and that's because the dean spoke about building ramps for him, it said he was encumbered by the wheelchair, not encumbered by his illness. And Michael had a way of always describing what burdened him as the medication, never as the illness. And having watched the difference between him in his unmedicated state and what a transformation it was for him to receive medication, again, that those little elisions of reality or truthfulness, obviously done as a way of sparing him what people feared might be stigmatizing, were in fact the kind of subtle falsification that already made his story almost the Hollywood version of itself. So when Ron Howard read it and read, here's a brilliant young man who, with the help of his heroic father, who was going to be a hero in the story, and these amazing professors graduated from Yale Law School, the arc of the story had already been written, and it had partly been written by Michael, who loved heroic stories.
And Leonardo DiCaprio was going to play him, and then I think it was Brad Pitt.
And then it was Brad Pitt.
Yeah. And what, Danny DeVito is his father, was it?
Well, no, but Michael loved to say to all the Yale professors, who do you think should play you? How about Danny DeVito?
Yeah.
And so, in a sense, he was casting them in the movie of his own life that was going to be projected.
It's a wild story. And then he had to also write his own story. He got a book offer, and that's part of it all. Very complicated, and a lot of pressure on his shoulders to perform and do what he really wasn't able to do. And Pat McGorry, as you're listening to this story and as you read Jonathan's book, How did you reflect on that tension that you're facing every day, no doubt, with people that you're supporting in your practice, of wrestling with a medication? And medication has been a really blunt instrument for many years, often. Mm. It's been quite hard for people to... It makes them feel bad, but it ironically also makes them better.
Well, I think the way Jonathan put it, the medication is not used in a careful enough way. You know, it doesn't have to be like that. And one of the things that we did research on was to show that very, very small doses of medication are sufficient in the very early stages of illness. And people get over-medicated a lot, especially if they present late in an acute episode. Mm-hmm. But you can actually, even PET studies have showed, you know, brain scanning studies have showed that you find a sweet spot that is below the side effect threshold but is clinically effective. That can be done if you're careful enough and you've got the right environment to actually do that. But listening to it, I think you do see that it's a very challenging diagnosis to incorporate into your identity at that stage of life, especially if you've got a healthy ego. It's a natural thing to denial is a very protective defence mechanism against any threatening illness. So it's a journey to actually come to some acceptance of it, and you need a lot of help with that. This is where the psychological sort of therapies are very important, and the relationship with a sensible, practical and skilled therapist. You know, you can't just devolve this to low-skilled workers. It's very challenging what needs to happen there. And the other thing was, I remember at that time all that optimism about early intervention was peaking around the time that Michael. So I can understand why he, as a poster boy for recovery, would have been very attractive to the field.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the drug clozapine, which had been shelved for about 10 years. For many years, actually, and revived in the early 90s as a result of some excellent research done in New York, actually. that is a drug. He was still not fully recovered, as Jonathan said. He still had persistent symptoms, even though he was better, so he was only partially recovered. But clozapine, a third of patients offered clozapine will completely recover at that point. He wasn't offered that, it doesn't seem like. So he did have a chance of more complete recovery if he'd been properly treated.
Mm. What happened in 1998?
So it looked to outsiders, to me, that he had achieved everything we had always wanted. He was a millionaire because he'd been paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to write this memoir and much, much more for the movie that was going to be based on the memoir, but that they were going ahead with anyway because, as the screenwriter said to me, sometimes it's easier if you don't have to wait for or adhere to the story. Mm-hmm. Also, when he had met Michael, and they did in order just to get the feel for what he was like, the screenwriter said to me, he looked like someone wearing a 5-point harness. He was incredibly stiff. He was determined, he felt, to demonstrate that he was, in fact, not ill at all. Although he told them a story that they loved, which was that he managed his hallucinations like a giant TV, where he had multiple screens, and there was the suicide channel, and there was the murder channel, but then there was the paradise channel, and then there was reality, and he would just enlarge the reality. And of course, people who make movies, and Ron Howard was a child television star, feel like, well, that makes perfect sense in its way. Which is not to say that somebody might not, in fact, gain that kind of control. But
there was a profound rationality to the way he articulated some of his experiences.
If anything, he was hyper-rational.
Yeah, and you were co-opted into that narrative in a way, all of you in a way.
When I visited Michael the first time in the hospital, he called me back with all these instructions. He wanted a book, The Literary Guide to the Bible, Frank Kermode and Robert Alter. But no one could see it because they didn't want him having it. So I had to wrap it up and bring him a tape recorder. And I was getting ready to wrap up the book, and my wife, who I was then not married to, but was much more sensible even then and worked in hospital, said to me, I think that is not true. I think that is a delusion. And I was... Partly it was I was used to listening to his authoritative voice. Mm. Partly it was told to me with such conviction. Partly because I think a lot of people don't realize that someone who might have severe mental illness could have an irrational premise from which many rational things are then deduced. Mm-hmm. So in fact, if you think your parents are Nazi replicas, arming yourself with a kitchen knife is probably a perfectly reasonable thing to do. Mm. And so all of these outward tokens of reason or rationality were present. So that
and
was already my first
also,
encounter.
I want to acknowledge the Hearing Voices movement because it is a network that is trying to have a more nuanced conversation about the experience of living with voices. So we won't probably get into that today, but it is part of a network who are trying to talk about this stuff, but it's damn complicated. Back to you.
And adding to the complexity, I think, with any of these things is when you extrapolate from some examples or experiences and establish a norm as a result of it. Everybody assumes, even today, that antipsychotic medication is horrible. Now, I would never pretend that it was a good thing, but as Pat was saying, there are doses of it that are enormously effective, not for all people, but for many. Mm. And the idea, though, that it is horrible is partly because Michael isn't the only one who attributed all of his difficulties to the burden of his medication. Mm. And nobody ever says, I had the best chemotherapy last week. Everybody understands that it's a burdensome intervention that is better than the alternative. Mm. But if you are not convinced, as he never really was, that you're ill, then this burdensome aspect that you're now dealing with would only seem like something maybe introduced against your will or that it was inimical, and that is an enormous problem.
And in all this, he had partnered and was living with his fiancée, Caroline. And I can't imagine what she was experiencing, limboing around these alternate realities that he was living with and wrestling with, no doubt.
I never answered your question about what happened in
1998. No, and so they'd moved in together. And that was a positive thing. We need people in our lives. But what happened was a complete and utter tragedy as a result of his lack of medical support.
Michael went off his medication. He couldn't write his book. He very much wanted to, especially because he didn't like the idea that someone else was going to tell his story. It suddenly ceased being a grand acknowledgement of his heroic life and became something else. He wanted to write his own story because we wanted to be writers. I was always amazed at how intent he was on that point, but he couldn't write it, and it wasn't his story at that point. He went off his medication and became increasingly delusional. There were times when he would not let Carrie in because he felt she was an alien or a spy, and the people caring for him knew this, but they were so intent because of the world, the social psychiatry world they'd grown out of, were so intent on saving him from the system that they didn't really rank saving him from his illness or saving Carrie from the worst effects of it higher than their prime objective. And he stabbed Carrie to death with a kitchen knife and then fled. Actually fled to a Cornell University where both he and I had received, won a fellowship as teenagers. I always was convinced that he had fled there because it was at a time when his mind was his friend. It was a very difficult fellowship to get into. We hadn't told each other we were applying. I worked incredibly hard to get in. He breezily told me he'd gotten in. He wound up there, flagged down a police officer, kept trying to explain that he thought he might have killed his girlfriend or a wind-up doll, and they didn't believe him, but gradually they did call the Hastings, where he was living, police department, and the person came on the line and said, hold him, he did exactly what he said.
Yeah. And there's much to that story, and you saw it all... And look, you do tell in a chapter, very profound chapter, Carrie's story as well, because often victims are not their stories aren't properly told. And his story, because of the Ron Howard factor and the advocacy, and it rolled out across the newspapers, and you saw him splashed on, you know, the front pages of the newspapers in a blue jumpsuit, and the headlines "psycho" and "killer" and all of that, and then a whole debate around the insanity plea, that and the complexities around that. He's been incarcerated for 25 years now. Why did you want to write this book? What was it about the telling of this story that you felt compelled to do?
Well, first, I spent many years not wanting to write the book and not wanting to tell what I didn't even know was a story. It was more this sense that something profound and terrible had happened to my friend, that I almost felt when I read about it, or actually I heard about it from my mother, who called and told me not to go home. Somehow she had some maternal terror that I would be at risk because he was still missing, which I thought was nonsense, although in retrospect it wasn't entirely nonsensical. But not because he would have come after me as me, if you know what I mean. But in any case, I did feel as if I myself might have done it. Like, I was shocked at how deeply entwined I was with his story emotionally and psychologically
and
in its aftermath.
In the days afterwards, you had terrible nightmares.
Terrible nightmares in the days afterward. But I also didn't know what had happened. I knew almost nothing about mental illness, severe mental illness. I had a terrible haunting memory of a conversation I'd had just a few weeks before, in which he said, I have to go now. I'm having thoughts I shouldn't be having. And I didn't ask myself, what might that really mean? Mm. Because, and still in some way, I continue to see him as the hare, which is awful. What I also, eventually, I had children, I got married, I had, when my younger daughter was 10, the age that I was when I met Michael, and she had a very close friend, and you realize, you know, your child is so small and so large, and this was her whole world. I began to feel, I suppose, drawn back. Eventually then I had to figure out what on earth
happened.
Mm. And what was amazing is how many people I met who were sort of guides. The psychiatrists who had cared for him, this couple, the husband, who was a very eminent psychiatrist, had joined the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, who is the guru in India, kind of a cult figure.
Who had a lot to say about mental illness, but that's a whole other story.
He did indeed. Mm. And the mother, who was also a psychiatrist and who loved Michael, died a year after he killed Carrie. But their daughter, who was grown, is somebody I wound up meeting, and she decided that she really wanted me to tell the story. Oh. And one aspect of it was all the psychiatrists and social workers in this world referred to themselves as the network. They were like an alternative mental health care system. Michael's actual psychiatrist came from this world, and there was only one person in that network who understood that this was a disaster waiting to happen, but no one quite listened to her. Mm. But that was one piece of it. Another piece of it was Michael's law professors. It never occurred to me he couldn't do the work. Why did an abstract idea of genius, which had been so important to the two of us when we were kids, like it was going to inoculate you against all the sorrows of the world to be smart? And Michael used to say, I may be crazy, but I'm not stupid, as if to say I'm not either. And to be smart is not, in that sense, to be mentally ill. Like, where did that association come from? So all of these elements kept emerging. The professors hadn't just been his law professors and mentors. They had helped change the laws that made it almost impossible to commit someone who required help. And so for them, too, that was a kind of reckoning. And so on the one hand, it was a very private journey, partly an exploration of my childhood. But on the other hand, you know, Michael lived on this short street of mine, and I always thought of him and probably myself as so unusual, so unique, and Brad Pitt was going to play him. And I kind of discovered he lived on everyone's street. And the number of people I met who were once removed from severe mental illness, and whether it had had the tragic outcome that Michael's story had, or had been a tragedy averted, was not the distinguishing feature. What was the distinguishing feature was that there had been no net to catch them. There had been no way to help someone simply because they were ill, as we would do for every other illness. Violence had become the only criterion for helping someone.
So I wonder, we've only got 5 minutes left.
Oh, and my.
I know. We could actually talk for 3 hours. Shall we just do that? Thank you for listening to this story, and thank you for telling it. And I can't imagine you telling this story in the way that you are at festivals like this. I just thank you for doing it and taking us there. But I do want to have a conversation in the minutes that we've got left about how we have a conversation about mental illness and violence, because the reality is that most people with mental illness, the only violence that they commit is against themselves. And that's the reality. But people and families also are desperate for a conversation because they're living with fear about a sense of palpable risk as well when people aren't getting the medical care that they need. This is a really complicated conversation to have, Pat.
I think it's actually more straightforward, actually. As you say, the general situation is that people with mental illness, even severe mental illness, are much more likely to be harmed by other people than they are to harm anyone else. In fact, their risk is lower than the general population as a group. But there's a subgroup of people, particularly as in Michael's case, when the delusions focus on close family members and they're clearly... the behaviours might make sense, as you said. You know, if you believe a certain sort of set of things are true, then your behaviour makes sense. So clinicians will know that. They'll know that the risk is there when that type of delusion appears. You know, and those clinicians should have known that even at that time. But that's a subgroup. It's a small and actually research in Sydney has shown that most of those murders are committed by people who have never been even diagnosed. So it's their first episode patients. So this is why early intervention, early detection is so important. You'll save a lot of lives if you actually find those people early and treat them and make sure they recover. So
huge challenge in doing that right now. We know that across Australia, particularly post-COVID, or as a result of COVID, nothing post about it, services are really stretched.
Well,
and young people are really
Well, here are the
troubled.
Facts. 50% of people in Australia with mental ill health of any kind will only 50% will get access to treatment, and the 15% of that treatment will be of acceptable quality. So that's the situation. If that was the case with breast cancer, diabetes, asthma, you name it, the public would be out in the streets. It would be completely unacceptable to the public. That is the situation. Now, COVID has definitely made it worse, particularly for the age group we work with, the teenagers and young adults. There's been a jump from 26% prevalence of mental illness in that age group in 2007 to 39% today. So this is a public health crisis in youth mental health. We've seen not a shred of action about this. The services that we have built are completely swamped and shrinking at a time when we've got this crisis. So now that's not just about psychosis, it's about anorexia, it's about the whole spectrum of problems. But buried in there are the emerging psychotic illnesses. And we have got the opportunity to pick them up early if we resource that safety net and that entry point. But we've got a whole other group called the missing middle who can't be properly treated in a primary care environment like GPs or Headspace, but they can't get into this high bar of the state-funded acute system. Mm-hmm. And you can see why people want to protect patients and people against entering that system, because it's so such an aversive experience even today to go into an emergency department with a mental illness. So you can see why people try not to act and intervene in those acute phases like these people did. But there's huge risk. So we have over 3,000 suicides every year in Australia. It's twice the road toll. And we have a subgroup of homicides which are committed by people who are untreated or poorly treated.
Mm. And that's why you're continuing to do the advocacy that you are in the best way that you can.
Yeah, but we need the public.
But it's hard getting it in.
Well, you know, the politicians, we're meeting Mark Butler later today about this, but the politicians are sympathetic, but they won't act unless you people rise up, you know, somehow and force them to do it.
And how do you want people to do that?
Well, there's an organisation I was telling you, Jonathan, called Australians for Mental Health that we have set up, like a Get Up for Mental Health, which is completely free of any government funding, and it's basically intended to mobilise the public. But I've spent 10 years trying to raise funds for that organisation, and it's struggling. We've got great people on the board, we've got a great CEO, but that's the sort of thing, that's the missing piece. Mm. And it's sort of a public momentum issue that we need to generate. I mean, you don't need to do it for cancer. They don't have to get out of bed, the cancer people. The donors and the government come to them.
Final word to you, Jonathan. What's been the response to this book, aside from Obama putting it on his top 23 books of the year? And thank you, Obama, for being a reader, and let's hope your next president is as well, America. and not just reading the tabloids. But what's been the response to this book?
For me, deeply moving. I mean, first of all, that sense that it is actually a universal story and has been very powerful for me. The number of parents who are trying to care for adult children with severe mental illness and who are continually having their efforts thwarted is not just thwarted. I mean, mm-hmm. people whose children are so sick and are adults and reject all care, mm-hmm. and there are no tools. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, that experience has been... I was afraid, and sometimes when I would give a talk at a particular kind of a venue, that I was telling a story with its worst outcome, and I didn't want people to think, this is going to reinforce the stigma. Mm. But in fact, the gratitude that the story is told in all of its detail or nuance based on a personal connection is what people respond to. I also think first of all, the number of people who thought they were honoring Michael's autonomy, but were in fact merely encouraging his illness and endangering his own life and Carrie's life is astonishing. And I think that that's really important, almost as if their fear of doing something stigmatizing when they knew that he was not in his mind is a very profound lesson for people. And what you began with about institutions, however flawed they are, were always presented with that challenge. Do we pretend they're the Bastille and knock them down altogether, or do we find what's necessary, good, and then recreate and then save them and reform them? So
you understand the subtitle of this book, The Best Minds, A Story of Friendship, Madness, and the Tragedy of Good Intentions. Jonathan will be signing books. Jonathan Rosen in the bookshop. That's the cover you're looking for. It is extraordinary, and I'm sure that many of you will have stories of your own that will intersect with this one. And sorry we didn't get to questions, but as you can understand, we needed to land in a gentle place here. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us, and please thank Jonathan and Pat as well.
Thank you. Thank you.